Hello, I'm Adrian Finnegan, and this is Counting the Cost on Al Jazeera, your weekly look at the world of business and economics. This week, the outcome of the presidential runoff in Turkey will likely determine its economic future. Will President Erdogan's policies win out, or will it be a reset of his unorthodox approach? Also this week, honing workers' skills to succeed in tomorrow's labour market. The World Economic Forum says that nearly a quarter of occupations will change in the next 5 years. Plus, consumers around the world are struggling with skyrocketing inflation, but first-class flight bookings are on the rise and luxury brands are enjoying bumper sales. Not an outright win for Recep Tayyip Erdogan in Turkey's presidential election, but the outcome was also a disappointment for the opposition, which was more united than ever. A runoff will take place on May 28th, with the state of the economy front and centre for voters. President Erdogan was criticised for reducing interest rates at a time of sky-high inflation, while most central banks did the opposite to keep prices down. If the opposition wins, that could mean a rethink of his policies. Uma Kulsum Sharif reports.
Soaring inflation and a plunging lira may be the deciding factors for voters during Turkey's presidential runoff on May 28th. The uncertainty has already rattled markets. The lira sank to a record low against the US dollar last week, and stocks tumbled. President Recep Tayyip Erdogan's policies are widely blamed for fueling inflation. Where other central banks raised interest rates to reduce prices, Turkey reduced rates. But Erdogan still holds the lead after the first round. Some analysts point to his 20 years' experience in which he oversaw rapid economic growth and job creation.
Government wants to increase the employment because of they believe that inflation, of course, is a problem. But if we look at employment, this is a success story.
However, Erdogan's unconventional economic policies have many worried. While campaigning, he repeated his mantra of increasing foreign investment, local production and exports to drive up GDP. Annual inflation soared to a 24-year high in October at 85.5%. And economists believe voters may call time on Erdogan's unorthodox approach.
At some point, something will have to give. By something, I mean either the interest rate or the exchange rate. If they insist on controlling the interest rate and the exchange rate, ultimately, the exchange rate will implode.
His rival, Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu, promised to reinstate traditional economic policies and regain the confidence of foreign investors. He also wants to amend Turkey's relations with the West.
I want justice and equality for Turkey's future. I want the conditions to change and for us to get what we deserve. Right now, we are heading towards downfall.
Two earthquakes devastated large parts of the country's southeast in February. The government estimates rebuilding cost at more than $103 billion, which means Turkey's economy will be a priority for whoever wins that runoff vote. Umi Kulsum Sharif for Counting the Cost.
Well, joining us now from Istanbul is Hakan Akbaş, Managing Director of Strategic Advisory Services. Good to have you with us again, Hakan. The presidential election was widely seen as a referendum on Erdogan's handling of the economy, and yet he edged it ahead, even though it's going to a second round. What do you make of that?
Yes, it was a historic election, and we are into the runoff round. And President Recep Tayyip Erdogan is closer to win. But I would say that this was more about security and nationalism than the referendum for Tayyip Erdogan's economic policies. In the sense that, yes, high inflation, high cost of living, they were all important. But President Erdogan turned that into a vote for the future of the country. And his campaign was all around, you need to vote for me because the stability and the continuity of your future depends on our success. And that seems to have resonated with the voters. And they gave him, his party and his ruling alliance, a clear majority in the parliament.
OK, so it wasn't necessarily about the economy. The markets, though, weren't happy. There was a certain amount of turmoil after the first round. Is that set to continue through to round two?
Yes, I think that's a great point. Part of it had to do with the pollsters just shockingly mispredicting the outcome. And obviously, they were predicting a clear mandate for the challenger, Kılıçdaroğlu, in the first round. That didn't materialize. So obviously, they are now repricing a runoff, which will likely lead to Erdogan winning. So I think until they find a new market, the new normal, that's normal. Going forward in the next 10 days until the 28th, where we will have the runoff, both leaders will also need to talk about their economic policies. And President Erdogan has already hinted that he may bring in his former deputy ministers, deputy prime minister of finance, Mehmet Şimşek, which would signal to me that he is considering switching back to more orthodox policies. And I think he would need to do that because after the election, especially during this election campaign, he had made a number of populist pledges, which he will need to carry on, like doubling the minimum wage or pledging to rebuild all the homes in the earthquake zones and so on. So it looks like if he's the candidate to emerge, he will need to reconsider his rather unusual economic policies to date.
So whoever comes to power after the second round, there will be economic changes. What do you make of the opposition's economic plans? Will they be willing to push up interest rates and risk a recession?
President Erdogan's economic model has been around, really lowering the interest rates to be able to boost growth and employment. The opposition, on the other hand, which has former Prime Minister of Finance Babacan and his team, and they announced that they will need to take on interest hikes. And right now, for example, the central bank's policy rate is around 8%, but the market lending rates from the banks is over 50%, 50. So I think that the market, according to the opposition's economic team, has already priced that in. So they will need to do that to be able to keep the FX exchange rates in check. Otherwise, we could be looking at a major devaluation of the local currency, Turkish lira, against dollar right after the elections. And even during this time, up until the runoff, we are seeing central bank and state-owned banks already intervening in the FX markets to keep the lira stable.
President Erdogan said that his policies were meant to promote economic growth. He's been swimming against the tide of market opinion. I mean, is there any chance that he could actually be right, that given long enough, his policies could pay off? Or, as you say, is he going to have to rethink if he wins this second round?
I think he would need to readjust his economic policies regardless, because, yes, he has been market testing his unorthodox policies to be able to boost growth. Yes, Turkey is projected to grow around 3% this year, according to EBRD's latest projections, and that is significantly below than 5 or 6% that Turkey needs to make to be able to provide employment to young people. So obviously, on top of it, as a result of low interest rate policy, we also had a significant issue with the depleted foreign exchange reserves of the Turkish Central Bank. And for example, since the beginning of April this year, they sold about $14 billion in the open market. So meaning that this is not sustainable. On top of it, Turkey has a current account deficit that needs to be financed. And given the current economic model, as per President Erdogan's economic policy team, that did not materialize. The exports did not grow as expected. And the trade deficit, on the other hand, has become much worse. So which tells me that what they have is unsustainable. And that's exactly why President Erdogan had hinted before the first round, had hinted that he may bring in a seasoned a bureaucrat like Mehmet Şimşek to take over after the elections.
Hakan, it's always great to talk to you on Counting the Cost. Many thanks indeed for being with us.
Thank you. Thanks for having me, always.
Technology advances and innovation to tackle climate change are changing our world at a rapid pace, and that's forcing an evolution in the workforce too. Some jobs will be lost, others requiring new skills will be gained. The World Economic Forum says a labour market churn lies ahead, resulting in a new era of turbulence. It expects nearly one in four occupations to change in the next 5 years. The WEF has recently published a report based on surveys of more than 800 companies. It says global employers could create 69 million new jobs by 2027 and remove 83 million positions. That'll result in a loss of nearly 14 million roles. Among the factors that will drive the labour market shift is artificial intelligence, which is developing fast. But it is macroeconomic events, including slower economic growth, supply shortages and inflation, that will pose a bigger threat to jobs than AI. Companies are rethinking the expertise that their employees need. However, the WEF warns that many workers will lack the necessary skills to keep up with the changes. We'll dig more into that with our guest shortly. But first, a new survey by the research group The Conference Board concluded that US employees are more satisfied with their jobs now than ever before, with more than 62% of respondents reporting overall contentment. That's the highest level since the group started to compile its reports in 1987. But there's a gender satisfaction gap. Women remain less content with their jobs than men. The lowest level of satisfaction was recorded more than 13 years ago, on the heels of what's now dubbed the Great Recession. Joining us now from London is Grace Lawton. She's the director of the Inclusion Initiative and an associate professor at the London School of Economics. Grace, good to have you with us on Counting the Cost. So we've got two reports to discuss here. Let's start with the one on job satisfaction. Are you surprised by this? And what is it that's making American workers so happy, or at least content with their jobs? And would we find similar levels of satisfaction elsewhere in the world?
You know, I think that the company who created the survey that is stating that American workers are happier, their base, who they actually go out to, are more likely to be professional workers or people who are at their desk. And I think that's a really good distinction to make, because people who are professional workers and more likely to be at their desk haven't in their whole working lifetime had as much autonomy as they do now. You know, even companies who are insisting that people come back to the office, they're insisting that they come back 4 days, for example. I know BlackRock in the US have just mandated 4 days, but we must remember that that's still more flexibility and autonomy than as compared to the past. So I think that this has been driven essentially by the cohort that we're looking at, that it is people who can work at home, and also the fact that they now have more work-life balance and essentially they have more control over their day-to-day.
Let's get on to business transformation then, workplace transformation. As we were saying a few moments ago, technology, things like AI set to transform the workplace. But as we were hearing, it's macroeconomic factors that will play a far bigger role over the next few years. In what way will they disrupt the workplace?
Yes, you know, I think that there isn't probably a macroeconomic factor that I could talk about today that won't have an interaction with technology and the fourth industrial revolution. And I guess the extent to which it makes workers' life easier or harder is still up for debate. But I think, you know, a lot of countries are looking at aging workforces, particularly the baby boomers who are retiring in many countries, mean that there's going to be skills gaps in sectors such as healthcare and education. Inflation also, of course, is playing a role, with upper pressure on wages in the job market, meaning that some people are choosing not to take work in order to stay at home, where employment benefits tend to be higher. And the cost of living crisis in general is moulding the job market. So I think these kind of macroeconomic trends that are long running, like aging, and the ones that are hitting us now, like inflation, both have the potential to interact with technology. And at the moment, the interaction technology is bringing out winners and losers in the job market.
Upskilling, Grace, is the new buzzword. What is it and how urgent is it?
I think it's pretty urgent. So I think a lot of where the gaps are emerging across the world, whether we're talking about developed countries or least developing countries, is in data science or at least in data science capabilities. And unfortunately, in pretty much every country around the world, the amount of data science that people are actually demanding doesn't quite meet the supply. So when we think about upskilling, it cannot just be in the general sense that we want to give people more money and more access to education. It needs to be that we're putting incentives in place to encourage people to go into the areas where the skill gaps are, where currently we aren't getting enough people choosing to study.
The World Economic Forum, Grace, says that 6 in 10 workers will require training before 2027, but only half of them have access to adequate training opportunities. Are companies willing to foot the bill for investing in their employees, you know, for providing training, and how can you persuade them to do so, given that it's vitally important?
I think the answer is both yes and no. So I think in companies where they have a war on talent, so kind of high finance, big tech, they are providing ample training opportunities for their employees, both in terms of giving them executive education that comes into their site and also lots of access to very high quality education online. I think the problem are for people who are in small and medium enterprises, which is probably the majority of people, plus individuals who aren't in these companies where you don't have these kind of huge wage premiums. And in those companies, there's generally been a reluctance to provide training because you worry, you invest in a colleague and then they decide to leave and go to a competitor, for example. And I think then it's up to the government to think about how they can either A, fill that gap through their own skills policies for small, medium enterprises and for companies where it isn't appealing to provide training, or B, where they put structures in place where they're requiring these companies and they're requiring these employers to provide the skills that employees need, both to serve their current employer, but more than that, so they can actually leave and get opportunities elsewhere.
Fascinating. Grace, really good to talk to you on Counting the Cost. Many thanks indeed for being with us.
Thank you so much. Thank you. Bye.
A pandemic, the war in Ukraine, slow economic growth and inflation. The global economy has gone from one crisis to another over the past 3 years. Yet the luxury sector recovered quickly after COVID restrictions were lifted, reaching more than $1 trillion in 2021. And it grew by up to 21% last year, beating all expectations, according to the consultancy firm Bain. Holidaymakers who spend big are leading a boom in first-class and business-class flight bookings. The International Air Transportation Association says that premium travel has recovered this year faster than total passenger traffic. Airlines are investing billions of dollars in their cabins to keep up with the demand. First-class lounges are being upgraded to mini hotel rooms with double beds and walk-in showers, for example, and you can even book a personal chef. Sales of high-end cars, watches and handbags have also been on the rise. France's luxury firm LVMH leads the way as the first company in Europe to cross the $500 billion market valuation threshold. Its founder, Bernard Arnault, overtook Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos as the world's richest person last month. While Hermès, the designer brand, reported that its revenues rose by 23% in the first quarter of the year. Joining us from London is Fleur Roberts, who is the Global Industry Manager at Euromonitor International with a focus on luxury goods. Fleur, good to have you with us on Counting the Cost. So who's leading this boom in first-class and business-class flight bookings? Is it companies or wealthy individuals?
Well, it's really kind of a mix of both, really. So obviously, we're still kind of very much at a stage where, you know, there's still a lot of pent-up demand in terms of travel. So lots of affluent consumers that previously would have travelled business class are obviously picking up travel again. They're very keen to get back on the road again and explore all these wonderful places around the world. So we're still seeing, you know, pent-up demand from affluent consumers. But there's also a lot of consumers that may, you know, have not been spending so much during the past, you know, 2 to 3 years, have saved a lot of cash and are really now very eager to kind of get out there and also really treat themselves. So kind of on the consumer side, a mix of both. And then on the business side, obviously, you know, corporate travel is not what it used to be, because we've got so used to conducting a lot of meetings online using Zoom or other kind of platforms to conduct meetings. But obviously it has picked up. We don't think business travel will kind of really ever return to what it was now that there are other ways of communicating. So a mix of both, really. But still a lot of wealth out there and still a lot of wealthy travellers out there.
Indeed. Right. But is the money that airlines are investing currently in their cabins and in their business lounges at airports money well spent? Is this boom going to continue?
Well, it will continue growing. So we're predicting around kind of 36% globally for this year. Obviously, this massive boom that we're seeing now has come from, you know, zero almost. So naturally, there's going to be a massive boom as, you know, people start traveling again and travel returns to some kind of normality. But naturally, with progression, as you know, it's just the natural way of data, it will start slowing down. Mm. That said, you know, we don't predict that we will go back to a decline again.
Okay. We've seen a rise in sales of luxury cars, watches, handbags. What is behind the general buoyancy of the luxury sector as a whole at the moment? Is it exactly what you were talking about there? Does the same apply to the luxury sector as a whole as applies to the airline industry?
We're kind of seeing a mix really across the board. So anything to do with experiences. So again, this is very much kind of on the back of being, you know, locked down for so long. So people really keen to have anything that involves a luxury experience, whether that's dining, whether that's travel, whether that's anything to do with hospitality or anything that will involve an experience. So that's where we're seeing, you know, big growth in luxury travel, luxury hospitality. But similarly, kind of on the more kind of personal luxury side, we're seeing a big growth in any kind of lots of the heritage brands, for example. So anything that will hold its value, people buying luxury goods kind of more as investments as opposed to just one-off pieces, people being kind of very mindful about how they're spending money. And this is, again, across the board. So, issues around sustainability really coming into play here. So on the one hand, it's about longevity, heritage, but also on the other hand, people are buying luxury goods with the idea that, you know, they can either sell them on and even make a profit in some cases, or they can always use those goods as a means of income and actually rent them out themselves, because, you know, there are so many rental platforms out there now.
Yeah. So you say that this is across the board. What do you mean by that? Is there any particular market or country that is driving this demand, or is it really a global phenomenon?
Kind of overall, in terms of those bigger trends, it's a global phenomenon. We're still seeing a lot of growth coming out of Asia. So overall, for this year, we predict about 7% growth for the luxury industry overall. That includes personal luxury cars, travel, etc. Most of that growth is going to come from Latin America, particularly markets like Brazil and Mexico. Also, Asia Pacific, you know, China. Although, you know, the Chinese will start traveling again, which is in the world of luxury hospitality or in the travel overall, you know, is probably the biggest story out there at the moment. But similarly, so a lot of growth within Asia Pacific, where the Chinese will probably travel more, at least for the short to medium term, but also in the Middle East, that's, you know, big talk at the moment. So traditional markets like Dubai or the UAE overall, but also Saudi Arabia, we expect a lot of growth to come from there, and a lot of that is on the back of growth in wealth or high net worth individuals.
Fleur, it's been great to talk to you on Counting the Cost. Many thanks indeed for being with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
And that's our show for this week. If you'd like to comment on anything that you've seen, you can tweet me. I'm at A Finnegan on Twitter. Try to use the hashtag AJCTC when you do, or you could drop us a line. countingthecost@aljazeera.net is our email address. As always, there's plenty more for you online at aljazeera.com/CTC. That takes you straight to our page. There you'll find individual reports, links, even entire episodes for you to catch up on. But that is it for this edition of Counting the Cost. I'm Adrian Finnegan from the whole team here. Thanks for being with us. The news on Al Jazeera is next.